From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. You know what they say, it's always 5 o'clock somewhere. So why not talk about beer this morning?
Hey Johnny, how about a beer, huh?
Ooh, a couple Charles Bukowskis?
A couple of Brustoyevskis?
Maybe a Mike Brugaslowski?
Perhaps a Teddy Bruski?
Or maybe you'd prefer something a little more traditional.
Good wines.
Whatever your chosen poison, we will talk today a lot about beer, including the best holiday beers, and hopefully that does not include pumpkin beer. Seriously, people. Then we'll explain the science behind drinking beer out of cans instead of bottles. But first, we talked about scams earlier this week. Georgia Power customers have been the target of phone scammers recently. Craig Bell from Georgia Power said those scams occur more frequently around the holidays.
If I had to put myself in the mindset of a scam artist, I would think that they would think this is probably an easier time that you would catch people who are receiving unexpected communications more frequently. And, you know, that just lends itself to the opportunity for you to be caught off guard by someone saying that, hey, your power bill is due right now. And if you don't pay right now, we're going to cut you off.
Raymond Tubb tweeted us in response to that. He told us about a scam in which someone reported a theft after they say people posing as power workers showed up and distracted them. That comes from customers of Flint Energies. And we'd love to get these stories from you. It's all important information. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Facebook or just tweet at us. It's at OST Talk. Remember, we might feature your comment on the show. There's little doubt that poverty can stifle children's growth in many respects. New research from the University of Georgia shows a clear link between poverty and brain development in children. But here's the thing. That study also shows that there are certain programs that are aimed at improving parenting and family relationships that can actually curb those negative effects on kids' brains. Joining me to talk about these findings is lead researcher Jean Brody, professor of child and brain sciences at UGA. Hi, Jean.
Hi, good morning.
And also with me from St. Louis is Deanna Bartsch, professor of psychological and brain sciences at Washington University. Hi, Deanna.
Hi, good morning.
Deanna, let me begin with you so that we can figure out what's new in this study. Can you tell me what exactly changes in a kid's brain because they're living in poverty?
Well, there are actually quite a number of different things that change in kids' brains when they live in poverty. One thing is that there are changes in the structure and function of different parts of the brain that are important for things like emotion processing and responding to stress. So parts of the brain like the hippocampus and the amygdala, which are really critical for those functions. There's probably also other changes that are happening in children's brains related to things like immune function and, different aspects of how the brain is connected up together.
How much is that related to things like poor nutrition or maybe bad environment with perhaps lead paint or even things like not getting proper vaccination and medical care?
That's a great question, and I think we really don't know yet exactly what parts are due to nutrition, exposure to toxins like lead, a lack of health care, or even the increased stress that children may experience living in poverty. So all of those likely have some contribution, and we haven't yet really teased apart exactly what parts of the changes in brain development are due to which of those.
So, Jean, that makes your job more difficult, right? How, if you're studying the effects of poverty on a kid's brain, and specifically how to counteract those effects, how do you control for all these different things that could be going on in an individual kid's life?
Well, not all children and adolescents who grow up in poverty experience adverse outcomes. And some young people and adolescents who receive supportive parenting develop resilience to the consequences of poverty, as researchers at Washington University have shown. And we're expanding these findings using a controlled trial of a prevention program, meaning that some people are randomly assigned to receive the prevention program while others aren't. And that makes people, the results of the study, less likely to be due to characteristics of the persons or their background.
So, and for this, the purposes of these studies, you're using the poverty level, the federally established poverty level to decide who's in poverty and who is not, Gene?
Yes, we are. And in addition, what we did is we didn't just use a snapshot of poverty at one point in time. We looked at the number of years that adolescents lived in poverty from age 11 to age 18.
Okay. So what exactly are these programs that, so I guess they're described as boosting parenting. What does that mean?
Sure. Well, when kids were age 11, they participated in a prevention program called the Strong African American Families Program, which enhances supportive parenting and strengthens family relationships. And
wait, so let me stop you there. When you say enhances parenting and strengthens family relationships, what does that actually look like specifically? What does that mean?
Well, what it means is it increases parents' involvement in kids' lives, both at home and at school. It increases communication. It increases consistent disciplinary practices in the home. And it increases kind of the consistency or family routines in the home environment.
So this is intriguing research, I'd imagine, for you, Deanna. What does this mean going forward? What other questions would you have in terms of how the amount of time you spend with a parent or a family environment might actually have changes that you can track inside a brain?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really important result because they actually were able to show that if you randomly assign families to this intervention, you can actually see, less of a negative effect of poverty on brain development. And I think the important next steps are to understand, well, what are really the active ingredients of these kinds of interventions? Is it the fact that parents are doing more monitoring of their children, so they're less likely then to engage in behaviors that might have negative effects on the brain, substance use or other sorts of things? Does it have to do with providing the children with better mechanisms for reducing their stress response, controlling their emotions? So there's likely to be a number of different kind of active ingredients in these interventions. And I think our next key steps are figuring out what are the really most important ones. And can we enhance, the intervention even further to really optimize those active ingredients?
That's Deanna Bartsch. She's teaches in the Psychological and Brain Sciences Department at Washington University, and also speaking with UGA Professor Gene Brody. His recent study shows programs that boost parenting can help fight the negative effects of poverty on child brain development. Gene, how long does someone need to stay in the program, or is this the kind of thing where you need to train families and parents how to do this and it needs to be sustained throughout their adolescence?
Well, that's a great question. The program itself involves 14 hours of participation by children and parents. This occurred when they were 11 years old.
14 hours total, not like
total,
per week.
Total.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah, so 14 hours total. This occurred when the youth were 11 years old. We're still following them, and they're 26 now. And when they were 25, they went into a scanner. We got MRI scans of their brains and looked at areas of the brains that promote learning, memory, and stress tolerance, and found 14 years later that there were differences in the brain volumes or brain development that supported these important functions for young adults. And interestingly, along the way, from ages 11 to 14, we have found that this program not only reduces drug use and conduct problems, but when we drew blood from them along the way, youth who participated in the Strong African American Families program had lower levels of stress hormones circulating in their bodies. They had lower levels of inflammation. And so it made sense to us that we also might see differences in their brain development.
Deanna, I have so many questions about this.
As do we all.
Yeah, we do.
How do you even begin to track? I mean, those are amazing results. So how do you begin to track what actually causes that? What leads to lower drug use? Which part of that, with only 14 hours of training, how does that suddenly end up in better immune systems and all of the other things that Gene just listed off? Where do you begin?
Well, I think that, you know, part of the important part to begin is going to be to go in and look at maybe different interventions that target different specific aspects of what he's done to try to see, okay, well, if we do something that's specifically focused on reducing stress responsivity, is that really the active ingredient? If we look at, you know, interventions that really focus on parents controlling, monitoring children and, you know, making sure that they're not engaged in, you know, substance use or other behaviors, can we then see whether that's the active ingredient? And I would also argue that we may want to even look at pushing these interventions earlier in life. I mean, they did this in the early teen years, which is obviously a really critical time for child development. But our own research has shown that you can see these effects even much earlier. And you can imagine that if you can sort of enhance parenting and family interactions and promote healthy child development starting even earlier, that you might see even more positive outcomes throughout the life of these children.
Jean, how much of this, and do you know whether some of this also had positive effects on the family as well, whether there might possibly be outcomes that you could track physiologically in parents and other siblings?
You know, that's a terrific question. We haven't looked at that, but clearly that has to be done. The whole idea that we can create more cohesive family environments means that there's kind of an arena of comfort that may be protective against stress for all family members, but we have no idea of that right now.
And Deanna, one of the ways I would imagine this is particularly powerful is that this is a program that says we should fight poverty, but we can make poverty less disastrous for a family and for kids that grow up, right?
Right, exactly. And I think you make a key point, though. Yes, these interventions, you know, are able to help mitigate the effects of poverty, and that's extremely important. We don't want to lose sight of the fact, though, that doesn't mean we don't need to also be continuing to fight poverty and to trying to determine ways to make sure that families aren't living in poverty to start out. But you're absolutely right. In cases where we really can't change that, it looks like there are things that we could do that could really help reduce those negative effects of poverty on children and help reduce the cycle of poverty.
And Jean, in the minute that we have left, what is your next study question? What is the next thing you want to isolate in order to move forward?
Well, moving forward, we're really looking at how enhancing family relationships can deter some of the health disparities that so many of the participants in our trial show. They are representative of the Black Belt that stretches from North Carolina, South Carolina, through Louisiana, and more than half of children growing up in this part of our nation grow up in the context of economic hardship. So we're really taking a look at the health benefits of programs like SAFE and other health and other programs that hopefully will have the potential to ameliorate some of the negative effects of poverty on health.
That's Jean Brody. He studies child and family development at the University of Georgia. He led this study that shows programs that bolster good parenting in families can curb the negative effects of poverty on the brain in kids. Also, Deanna Bartsch, professor of psychological and brain sciences at Washington University. Deanna and Jean, thank you both so much.
Sure.
Thank you for having us.
Bye-bye.
In about 10 days, lots of families will gather around a table for a holiday meal, and you can be sure most of those tables will include some form of delicious drink. Now, if your mind has immediately gone to wine glasses, or we're in the South, maybe sweet tea, stop right there. There is another tasty option that you can serve with all those sweet potatoes and greens and turkey. It's craft beer. John Eisenhower teaches a beer class at Kennesaw State University, and he holds the unofficial title of Beer Professor. I spoke with him last year.
Beer professor is my nickname. The actual title is I'm associate professor of beverage management, which is, I think, a political kind of thing because I just teach the beer culture class.
Right. There's not some other beverage like lemonade that you're teaching.
No, it's just beer. Yeah, and I cover all the facets of it, all the different styles and the history and anthropology and sociology and biochemistry of it. It's a fun thing.
And beer is a complicated issue because, I mean, people tend to think, you know, I go to my store and I see what's there, and there's American beer and there's European beer or whatever. But there's actually a huge number of different kinds of just beer itself, like types, not even just the breweries, right? I mean, we're talking about people who brew this particular type of ale. Am I getting this wrong?
No. There's probably 25 major styles of beer, and within those, there's sub-styles. So you might have your stout, and then you'd have regular stout, Irish stout, Russian Imperial stout, and so on and on. There's a pale ale. There's, you know, IPAs. And IPAs are the big thing right now.
So let's talk about IPAs. What's an IPA?
Okay. IPA stands for India Pale Ale, and it's because when the British soldiers were over in India, they would ship the beer over and it would become infected. And hops are known as a preservative. They have antibacterial and preservative qualities. So they increased the amount of hops to ship over to India so it would make it. And that style was popular. And then the Americans glommed onto it. And now there's a million kinds of IPA in almost every grocery store.
So if I'm sitting down and I'm trying to decide what kind of beer I'm going to serve with my holiday meal.
I think you should serve beer with every meal.
Okay. So here I am. I'm sitting down and I'm cooking for a large different variety of people. And there's going to be somebody there who says, no, thank you. I don't like beer. What's the most unobjectionable beer that's sort of your gateway beer?
Well, I think of it depends on what style of beer. I get many people that tell me they don't like beer.
Yeah.
And then I say, that's because you haven't tried one that you like. And with there being everything from fruit-flavored Belgian lambics to, Russian Imperial Stouts.
Is there any particular one that elevator music, is there a one that just kind of appeals to the widest variety of people?
Well, right now, the largest consumed beer in the world is Pilsner style. And that happened probably around the mid-1800s, 1850, 1860.
It's been the most popular since the 1800s?
Yes. There's technology behind that. We used to drink kind of murky beer out of clay. And then what we did is we developed glass technology so you could see it. And then all of a sudden, the Pilsner styles, which are aged, then these were all developed in Bohemia. Like there was actually a Budweiser in Bohemia and Pilsner Urquell. And so the Germans that were migrating to America came and got those styles. Some cases, they took the name of the beer, moved to America, and then started mass production of them. And it's become the behemoth that it is today.
So if I'm drinking Coors Light, I'm drinking a Pilsner.
Yep, you're drinking a Pilsner.
If I'm drinking Bud Light, I'm drinking a Pilsner.
You're drinking a Pilsner. Now, they're only vaguely close to the original ones because they've evolved over the hundreds of years.
Yeah.
But they still are that style, and that's the most popular.
Okay, so let's go back to our holiday meal. And you said you serve a different beer with each entree?
Each course. And typically, in general, with pairings, you either want to get something that's similar flavored, so they kind of compare nicely,
yeah,
or they are very different so that they complement each other that way.
Okay, well then let's play that game.
Okay.
Let's say I'm starting with a salad, right?
Okay.
A fresh green salad. What beer do I pair with that?
So if you're going to have salad, you're going to have things that have some spicy notes to it. And so that would go well with a Pilsner, possibly a German wheat beer, things like that. The lighter ones.
A Hefeweizen is what we're talking about?
Yeah, a Hefeweizen. Wow, that's a good one. Yeah, a Hefeweizen. The Belgian wit beers would go well with that. The American lighter lagers, there's a few very well-made Pilsners in the United States. And I think the lighter ones are perfectly technically correct. They're just lighter than some of the craft palates want.
Yeah, just something a little crisper, I guess, if you're starting with a salad. So, okay, we move on from the salad and we get our first course, which is most likely something like maybe it's stuffing or potatoes, something heavier and kind of starchy.
Okay, so when you get into the heavier beers, and you want to do with intensity. So the more intense the flavor of the food, and especially with fat, the more intense you want the flavor of the beer so one doesn't just overwhelm the other.
So if you have just potatoes with butter, that's different than if you have, say, garlic mashed potatoes.
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I would say if you're going to do a heavy garlic mashed potato, then you'd probably want to cut it with something like an IPA with a lot of hop bitterness into it.
But if I'm doing just the butter...
Yeah, then you could back off and do something like a regular American pale ale.
Should I feel snooty about American beer? Every time I speak to somebody from Europe, they disparage American-made beer.
Well, I think that's historically that's been true, but anymore, The last time I was in Belgium, I went to a very famous lambic brewer, and he was wearing an American brewery shirt at the job.
Are you going to tell us which brewery?
It was Cantillon, and he was wearing the Goose Island shirt.
Oh, nice.
So they're changing, and you know, we were disdained because after Prohibition, all the small breweries disappeared, and the big guys that could weather the Prohibition storm were all making fairly similar. They were low flavor, low hop, low malt beers that appeared to the masses. Now, one of the things that about America is we're a lot hotter than a lot of Europe, and so having a Russian Imperial Stout in the middle of an American summer doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and so certainly here in Georgia.
Yeah, yeah, and so you know, so I drink seasonally. So I will drink lighter beers in the summertime and heavier beers in the fall and winter.
And where do you lie on the whole issue of room temperature beer or cold beer?
Okay, so the room temperature or cellar temperature in London is different from cellar temperature in Atlanta. So, and one of the things that I think is important to note is that your ability to taste malty sweetness as the beer gets colder drops out quicker than hop bitterness. So if you take a beer out of an iced cooler that's meant to be drank at 48 degrees, it's going to taste really lopsided. It's going to be very much more bitter. Just like if you took an American Budweiser or something and warmed it up to 48 degrees, it's not going to taste right. And so the beers are made for certain temperatures. And so my theory is if you're going to go with the craft thing and a pairing, let the beers warm up to, you know, at least 45 degrees before you start serving them.
Okay, so let's go back to our dinner.
Okay.
We've just had, say, potatoes, and now we're ready for our main entree. Let's say that I have made turkey, our most common meat protein, during a Thanksgiving Day dinner. Let's imagine that this is a relatively not strong flavored food. Then what do I put with it?
So now we're talking about things that are more roasted.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at the malts that are roasted, malt is what makes beer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sprout it and you put it in an oven and you cook it just like you would roast a vegetable. And the darker you roast it, the darker the beer color is.
So, darker, you mean the longer you cook it?
Yes, the longer you cook the grains to make the beer, the darker they get. And
right.
So lightly dried ones would make a good American Pilsner or you know, any kind of light ale. The medium dark makes good Oktoberfest, and then you're getting into the roasted, so it's roasted like a vegetable or a meat dish. And so any malt forward kind of thing, if you're talking about like turkey or ham, the Scottish ales are malt forward.
Like a Guinness?
Yeah. Well, a Scottish ale would be something, Jekyll makes one. Monday Night Brewing makes one called Drafty Kilt. Yeah. And so the Scotch ales are malt forward. Brown ales are malt forward that would pair pretty well. There's Belgian style called Double. Mm-hmm. That would pair pretty well with roasted, or even a triple, although I tend to say start with the low alcohol, lighter flavored beers and work your way towards the heavy dessert beers. So you don't want to overwhelm your palate.
Okay, so then we move on to dessert. We've had our meal. We're moving on to dessert. And let's say it's something that's very, very sweet, like a creme brulee. What do we then serve with something which is quite sweet?
That's when I would go into the things that are more roasted, that you can get coffee or chocolate notes out of, the porters and the stouts. So I would go with something like Jailhouse Brewing here makes a breakout stout. There's a Creature Comforts Brewing makes a porter called Coco Boonie, which is made with lactose, coconut, coffee, vanilla, and chocolate. So that would
good.
Go with the dessert
yeah.
pretty well. Kennesaw's Burnt Hickory has something called a graham cracker stout, which has a pretty noticeable cinnamon effect in the graham cracker flavoring of it. And then Red Hair has something called Sticky Stout, which is more of a classic stout that goes with chocolates and heavier things. Even a double cream ale or a double cream cheese would go well with that. But then your lighter beers with a lot of effervescence would go with that too, because the effervescence washes away the heaviness of the cheese.
Would it make a difference to you how heavy that dessert is? A creme brulee is quite light, but what if I was serving a cheesecake?
Cheesecake is thick enough to where it would go pretty well. I wouldn't suggest a Russian Imperial Stout with a salad.
Right.
It would just wash it away and you'd
never taste the salad.
No, you'd never get the salad. But with something thick like a cheesecake, there's enough fat in it to where something with a lot of coffee and chocolate notes from the malts would wash it away. But that would also be done with an IPA. So really, if you you look at any number of different books, they will just say, here's some general guidelines, and you decide what you want to do. But you have to know some place to start if you're not a beer aficionado.
Right. Not a whole lot of people are. How do you obtain that knowledge? You just have to taste them all?
That's a fun way to start. and in fact, there's whole books on just beer and cheese pairings. And then there's many web resources that talk about guidelines. And now, even if you go into a grocery store, you'll see so many different kinds of beers that you didn't even see 20 years ago. It's really amazing. And breweries are popping up all over Georgia.
So let's go back to the snooty level. How do you feel about flavored beers then? I mean, are you the kind of person that posts angry rants about pumpkin spice beer?
Well, back when I used to be a pub brewer, and the crowd always wanted a pumpkin spice ale. And the problem I had with that, I don't care for nutmeg so much, so that's not my thing.
Yeah.
But the spicy notes get into the draft lines, and the next beer you put on for like 3 days is going to taste like pumpkin spice. So that's really my issue with it. And if somebody wants to come out with a habanero pineapple IPA, that's fine. My concern is that the shelf space, there's only finite shelf space, and there's probably going to be, it's probably going to swell a little bit further, and then it's going to have to collapse back to what's manageable.
So you're just worried about those beers crowding out the better ones?
Well, I tend to favor the classic traditional beers because they've been around for hundreds of years for a reason. And so it may be that it's kind of fun to make, like a pineapple, habanero porter or something. But there's a reason that those styles haven't existed for hundreds of years. Now, they're fun to, for brewers to make. And if they take off, then we could come up with a whole new style. And Americans are incredibly ingenious about throwing everything but the kitchen sink into a beer. And some of these profiles, I think, work very well. Some of them are fairly constrained in their limited release. It's like, we're going to try this once and see what happens.
So how is Georgia's beer? We do have craft breweries cropping up here. Are we good at it yet?
Yeah, I think so. I'm in the industry, so I'm a little bit biased.
Yeah.
So I believe that there's some excellent beers being made in Georgia, and they're growing everywhere. There's a brewery now in Kennesaw, which I didn't think would happen in my lifetime. And there's breweries in Alpharetta and Woodstock and Savannah, and they're just showing up everywhere. There's several downtown in Atlanta. The Five Seasons Brew Pub, I think, is a really popular one. And in fact, I'm taking my class there, so we're going to do a beer food pairing.
Oh, now I see why people take your class.
Yeah, they have to write it up.
Oh, okay.
And one student just sent me a report that said that was awesome. And it's like, no, I train them to think about what it is they're tasting and smelling. And you have to subtract what you like when you're being an analytical person from, I give them two pages. Say what you like on the back. Tell me what you're perceiving, because I'm training their palates on the front score sheet.
Okay, so let's go back to our hypothetical dinner.
Okay.
We've finished dessert, and we're getting ready to just sit down on the couch or whatever and chat. What would you suggest is a good after-dinner beer?
Okay, the after-dinner beers are when you bring out the big guns.
Right.
So barley wine.
Because they're not competing with any food.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
Well, and then if there's some snacks, like some salty snacks or something, people are satiated, and you haven't fed them so much alcohol during the meal that their taste buds are blunted. So they can sip on something. And beer as a sipping beverage, when you get out the barley wines or the Russian Imperial Stouts, you shouldn't really be drinking those by the pint anyway. In my opinion, not if you're going to be driving anywhere. And so you just pour out a few ounces, and they have a huge complexity of aromatics. When you get the alcohol level up, alcohol is a flavor enhancer. And then when you get more higher alcohol beers, then you end up getting more products of the yeast can throw off different kinds of aromatics and esters. And so the beer is much more complex. So it's something you sniff and sip rather than, generally the first beers of the evening are consumed a little bit faster. And so that's why you want to start with something a little bit lighter.
And do you drink water while you're also drinking beer?
I alternate. I try and do about the same amount of water as beer, just because you can get dehydrated if you're sampling.
Which leads to a hangover the next day.
Yeah. And so I think, moderating your intake and then taking the time to think about what it is you're consuming is really key.
Now, John, do you cook for the holidays?
Oh, I cook all the time, yes.
Yeah? And you go through this whole process that we're talking about each time in terms of pairing your entrees with your beer?
Well, it depends on who's coming over and what their background is. I know what I like. And basically, I don't use water in cooking. I always use some kind of beer I have on hand.
That was Kennesaw State University professor John Eisenhower. He teaches a class on beer, but we are not ready yet to put down our glasses. Georgia is not particularly welcoming to the craft beer industry. In fact, our state ranks 48th for number of breweries per capita. And yet a new one will open its doors next year. And when it does, the Oconee Brewing Company will pour its beer into cans instead of bottles.
Small beer is about to get big. How big, you ask? So big it gets its own can.
Many craft breweries are making the switch from glass to aluminum these days, and we'll talk about why in just a few minutes. But first, it occurred to us that lots of people talk about craft beer without really knowing what craft beer is or how it's different from other beers. And so, we decided to break it down. Break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again. Break it down now. There are more than 4,600 breweries in the U.S., more than any other market, and craft beer accounts for about 12% of beer sales. That's about $22 billion worth of the amber nectar. Beer is categorized in a few ways. You can separate them by style: malt beer, spice ale, pale ale, pilsner, etc. You can also label them by taste: hoppy beer, crispness, maltiness, or smokiness.
Take a drink and you'll sink to a state of pure inebriation. You'll be tanked like the whole Irish nation.
And you can file beer by how it's produced. There's macro beer. Those are the big brands like Heineken and Budweiser.
Budweiser.
There are budget beers, which are usually mass-produced, but of lower quality, like Pabst Blue Ribbon or Keystone Light.
Now we must act as our own bartender.
And then there's microbrew. Let's be clear from the start that microbrew is not the same as craft beer. A microbrew is small, right? That's what micro means. When microbrewery first became a common term in the U.S., it meant a place that made fewer than 15,000 barrels per year. To put that in context, one Budweiser plant in Ohio makes 10 million barrels of beer every year. So micro, when it comes to beer, is really, really micro.
Taste it. It's delicious. It's just gotten smaller, that's all.
It's perfect. It's unbelievable.
It could change the world.
The term craft brew didn't get much play until after microbrews. Some people use the labels interchangeably, but that's just not correct. Sorry. Microbrew is usually boutique beer. It's specialty brews.
Hey, Johnny, how about a beer, huh?
Ooh, a couple of Charles Bukowskis?
A couple of Brustoyevskis?
Maybe a Mike Brugaslowski?
Perhaps a Teddy Bruski?
Sometimes macro breweries will make a micro brew, like a special Christmas ale from Heineken. I'd imagine it's better than this Christmas beer.
Beer nog. How do you make beer nog?
Well, you take a big old bowl of eggnog and you pour it down the sink. And then you drink a beer.
But craft beer is not the same as microbrew. The Brewers Association says craft beer is small, independent, and traditional. There are no real standards for how microbrew is made or what ingredients are used. There are both in the craft brew business. And when they say small, they mean no more than 6 million barrels of beer annually. It used to be 2 million barrels a year. The most successful craft brewer in America used to be Sam Adams. When Sam Adams crossed the 2 million barrels a year mark, the Brewers Association upped the limit.
Never miss an opportunity to enjoy a tasty Samuel Adams lager, especially when it's on someone else's tab.
When the Brewers Association says craft beer is independent, that means no more than 25% of the company can belong to a non-craft brewer. That's designed to weed out craft beers that are secretly owned by big macro brewers. For example, did you think that Blue Moon was craft beer? Wrong. It is made by Miller Coors. So is Terrapin. What about Goose Island or Red Hook? Wrong again. Anheuser-Busch owns more than 30% of those breweries. The final stipulation is the trickiest, because it can't be reduced to a number. A craft beer has to be traditional.
It's a craft beer. You got to make it stronger. That's what a craft beer is.
According to the Brewers Association, that means the beer's flavor derives from traditional or innovative brewing ingredients and their fermentation. Flavored malt beverages like Mike's Hard Lemonade and Smirnoff Ice don't qualify, they say. Sorry, guys.
That's not fair.
You only should be concerned with what's...
You're not fair.
Like it or not, that's the way it is. Anyway, the Brewers Association changed the definition of craft beer in 2014. It used to include brewers where at least half of what they made was malt beer. Remember how I said Sam Adams used to be the top craft brewer? Well, in 2015, the company slipped to number two, and that's because of the definition change. Traditional now includes ingredients like corn and rice instead of just malt.
There actually is a corn flavor to it. It brings out a unique character that barley doesn't have.
That change means that the brewing company, Yingling, gets under the craft brew umbrella. Yingling is the oldest brewery in the U.S., and it makes its beer with corn. So, according to the Brewers Association, a craft beer is small, independent, and traditional, but not everyone agrees with that definition. If you want to start an argument in a hipster bar, bring this subject up.
Just so you know, it's not your typical bar. They specialize in molecular mixology. It's kind of like an experimental new way to consume alcohol.
No time now to visit a hipster bar. The definition of craft beer that we've talked about is as close as we're going to get to an official definition. And so that's what we'll go with. Small, independent, and traditionally made. Now, of course, we are not beer experts, so we have brought one with us to help us understand all of this. Brewer Taylor Lamb is part of the Oconee Brewing Company, coming up in early next year in Greensboro, Georgia. Welcome.
Hey, thanks. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so what did we miss in that craft beer explanation?
I don't know that anything was necessarily missed. I mean, in breaking down craft versus microbrew, I think craft kind of speaks to the method in which beer is made. So a lot of people don't realize how hands-on and labor-intensive beer making can be. And so, you know, craft beer to me means that it's a small brewery that where the brewer or any other personnel in there is very hands-on. I mean, they're hand opening and closing valves, they're connecting hoses. Sometimes you're climbing down into tanks to scrub them. You're lifting 50-pound bags. It's just a lot of labor involved. And I think, you know, specifically that kind of speaks to craft beer versus some of the larger, more automated breweries.
So then let's go back to what we mentioned earlier, which is the fact that you guys are going to be putting your beer into cans.
Sure.
And this, I understand, is a trend.
It is, yeah. I mean, you can kind of see this market trend happening. I mean, just go into your local grocery store or package store. You're starting to see a lot more craft beer in cans versus glass bottles now. So so it's an obvious trend that's happening.
But as I remember it, most beer used to be in cans decades ago.
Correct.
And they went to glass because glass was supposed to make it taste better.
And I think that's kind of a misconception that a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, beer out of a can, it's going to have this kind of aluminum metallic taste. Not the case. I mean, perhaps that was the case back in, you know, the 50s or 60s, but cans have come a long way. And that's the quality of the beer itself is equal to that of beer in a keg or in a bottle. So there's a lot of benefits to cans. And looking at cans versus bottles, there's two things that can kind of minimize the shelf life of beer in bottles, and that's sunlight and oxygen. And neither of those can affect beer in a can. So you're looking at being able to preserve the quality of the beer for a longer period of time with beer in a can.
So if I leave my Oconee brew in my can for 6 months, it'll still taste as good as it was on the day you poured it in?
Absolutely. That's the idea. Versus, you know, a glass bottle, you know, the packaging has come a long way as well for bottles. And so, you know, it's not as big of an issue as it was perhaps in the past. But if a bottle is exposed to direct light, it'll kind of take on this skunky flavor. If you've ever heard anyone describe a beer as skunky, either in
I don't even know what that means. But it sounds bad.
Yeah, it is bad. So being able to eliminate that risk of beer being able to be affected by sunlight or oxygen is a bonus.
Where does the oxygen? I guess because the bottle just has a cap on it, and yet the aluminum can is sealed.
Correct. Yeah,
and that's why the oxygen matters.
Exactly. So I mean that's kind of one of the more popular topics that comes up in looking at cans versus bottles. For us personally, in Greensboro, Georgia, it kind of has a local twist to it. There's a recycled aluminum processing facility in Greensboro. It's a company called Novellus, and so a lot of the recycled aluminum throughout the state of Georgia kind of cycles its way through Greensboro, and the aluminum process into these 55,000-pound blocks that are then rolled out and formed into cans. So it's kind of cool to think that, you know, a lot of the aluminum that ends up being in a can starts its journey coming through Greensboro as well. So.
And since we've mentioned recycling, it's actually way easier to recycle an aluminum can. A lot of places don't even take glass anymore.
That's correct, yeah. And, I mean, you can kind of squash a can down much easier to recycle.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about beer with Taylor Lamb. He is the co-owner and brewmaster at the Oconee Brewing Company, and he's been explaining why they're going to be pouring their beer into cans instead of bottles. I wanted to go back to what you were saying earlier in terms of hands-on craft beer brewing.
Yeah, beer making, yeah. Yeah.
So are you really standing there while the beer is? I mean, that seems incredible to me. You're standing there adjusting dials while it's brewing?
Yep, absolutely. So there's kind of the brewer's platform kind of in between these two.
Like a raised.
Yeah, exactly, off the ground. And so you've got your cold water and your hot water coming in, and you're going for an ideal temperature. So you're trying to adjust the dials of the water valves to achieve that ideal temperature. And I mean, so you're constantly monitoring time and temperature and cleaning, sanitation. All these different.
So you're like a mad scientist running around the lab.
Yeah, exactly. So as opposed to sitting behind a computer or pushing buttons for a more automated system, this is very, very hands on.
Is that the equivalent of throwing shade at Budweiser?
Well, I suppose.
Somebody sitting behind a computer. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the evolution of the craft beer industry.
Sure.
And whether or not there's still room for growth, because as I mentioned, craft beer right now makes up 12% of sales, and that's a lot.
Yeah, and it is growing.
You think it's going to grow more?
I think so, and specifically here in Georgia. I mean, Georgia's kind of playing catch up to some of the other southern states. You look at North Carolina, for example, and more specifically in Asheville, western North Carolina town that has, gosh, I don't know how many breweries now. I mean, about 30, 40, maybe even more than that. And so they kind of become these hubs of craft breweries and these destinations for people to go to. And so absolutely, I think there's a lot of room for growth for craft breweries in Georgia and nationwide.
But aren't you concerned about some of the laws here that sort of regulate and limit craft breweries?
Yeah, I mean, that's a topic that often comes up. I mean, for me personally, from Georgia, so coming back to the home state to open a brewery was very important, and I see the potential of where craft beer can go in the state here. So yes, I mean, there's some regulations that are a little more strict on how we can operate here in Georgia versus some of the other states, but I think we're moving in the right direction, and we're just happy to be a part of this growth in Georgia.
So then let's go to a more controversial subject, which is this whole definition of craft beer and whether or not you agree with the Brewers Association definition, because I know that a lot of people feel like 6 million barrels, for example, is too much if you're talking about craft beer. Where do you fall on this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not a big I don't necessarily draw a line in my mind as far as, you have to produce under, this amount of barrels per year to be considered a craft brewery. I mean, I kind of go back to craft just being more defining the method in which it's the beer's being made. So, if you're still pumping out, thousands of barrels, but yet it's still a very hands-on and kind of this labor-intensive atmosphere there, then sure, I think you're still considered a craft brewery in my mind.
So, how many barrels is Oconee planning to pour when it opens next year?
Yeah. So, I mean, our goal is within our first year to produce 1,000 barrels in year one, and obviously grow from.
So
from
you're
there.
Way within the 6 million barrels.
We won't be approaching that line for a little while, but So. We'll
and
be.
How many flavors of beer are you hoping to start with?
So we'll start with three, possibly four year-round beers, and then have seasonal beer offerings on top of that. And plan to do like a barrel-aged beer program as well, taking beer and putting it in, old bourbon or wine or tequila, rum, whatever wooden barrels you can get your hands on. It's kind of a cool specialty project to do as well.
Is there a Georgia favorite beer? I mean, is there a style of beer that Georgia tends to favor?
That's a good question. I mean, not that I can really think of. I mean, I feel like the constant battle is, or kind of task at hand is converting people that aren't as familiar with craft beer, that maybe they've been drinking just kind of your standard domestic beers for a number of years, and getting them to try a more flavorful craft beer.
Okay, so let's do that then.
Yep.
Let's say I've been drinking Pabst PBR
sure.
for the past 20 years.
Sure.
What do you tell me to get me to try your craft beer?
So, in my opinion, you'd want to start with something light. And so one of our year-round beers will be, it's a German-style Kolsch beer. And so it's a very light, clean, crisp, refreshing, low alcohol percentage, kind of a good gateway beer, if you will. So, I think getting someone to be willing to try that would kind of open their mind to think, okay, well, there are more flavorful and tasty beers out there, so let's see what else there is.
Okay. And so since we just finished talking about beers that might go well with the holidays in the 30 seconds or so that we have left,
sure.
Is there a particular beer that you think goes well in the wintertime?
Yeah. I mean, I'm always drawn to the darker beers, maybe, a good hearty stout or something that...
something that feels like you're chewing it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that, but... I kind of envision, cozying up by a fire, and you've got your mug of just kind of a tasty stout, or brown ale, porter, some sort of dark beer. I feel like in my mind goes well with the holiday
season.
Something
that's got some teeth.
Yes,
That is Taylor Lamb. He's the co-owner and brewmaster at the Oconee Brewing Company. It opens early next year in Greensboro, Georgia. Do you have a date yet?
We're aiming for March. Not a specific date, but looking to have beer ready for distribution by March.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today, but we have to hear from you because I know there's a lot of people that are listening and like beer. So give us a recommendation. Look, even if it's PBR, if that's what you love, we want to hear about it. Tell us what you think is the best beer, and then call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Facebook, of course, or just tweet at us. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, this is On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.